Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, July 24th, and thank you for joining us today for this very special edition of our show. All of our guests on the Lifeboat Hour are exceptional human beings, but today we have with us another exceptional human being whose life and work are stellar in terms of raising consciousness about the preciousness and the precarious future of our planet. My guest today needs no introduction to most of you because he's become a household name among ecologists and environmental activists. I'm talking about Derek Jensen, author of A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, Volumes 1 and 2 of Endgame, and his most recent book, Dreams. He's co-authored other books and has written numerous articles and has traveled and spoken in countless venues. Last year, Derek interviewed me on Deep Green Resistance Radio, and I'm hoping that today I can provide an interview of him that comes close to or equals the beauty of the interview he gave me. Derek, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Derek, I'm going to start at the very beginning of your life and move forward, perhaps not chronologically, but at least having your early life as a starting point for the other questions I'm going to ask you. In almost all of your public lectures, you refer to growing up in an abusive family and how this experience shaped your development as a human being and as a writer and an activist. Now, as a survivor of an abusive family myself, I know that talking about one's upbringing in such a family is never painless, but I'm wondering if you'd tell us a bit about how your family system, tell us a little bit about your family system and how the violence you experienced influenced your worldview.
Well, that's a great question. And the brief background is that my father was extremely violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And so far as how this, and a couple things. One of them is that one of the things that really saved me as a child is the understanding that things don't have to be the way they are. And I remember asking as a child, if his behavior is making him happy, why is he doing it? And in many ways, that question informed a lot of my work later on and continues to inform my work about the larger behavior. You know, a lot of my work is about how can this culture perpetrate these atrocities? How is it that, you know, this culture can be killing the oceans and most people don't seem to care? And there's, you know, much later in my life, I read some things that are very interesting. One of them is R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which I would say are also the three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. And rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this meant within my family is that we could talk about anything we wanted except for the violence that we had to pretend wasn't happening.
Right.
And on a larger scale, we can talk about anything we want except for the the violence we have to pretend isn't happening. So, you know, United States is exporting freedom and democracy all over the planet. You know, recently, even it's in mainstream news that they're talking about how humans could go extinct by the end of the century. Even in the mainstream news, they're talking about this. And even given that, we still can't question, as a mainstream, the mainstream is still not willing to question capitalism, much less civilization. Is right. There's this great line somebody wrote. Robert Coombs, I believe the guy's name is, says, unquestioned beliefs are the real authorities of any culture. And I've always loved that. And that goes back to what I said about how somehow as a child I knew that what was happening wasn't necessary. And that's really important because one of the things that perpetrators will attempt to do constantly, both on a personal and larger social scale, is attempt to naturalize their oppression. This is one reason I can't stand Richard Dawkins' work so much. I can't stand so much of that, of also the ideology underneath capitalism, because both of those are attempting to naturalize exploitation. You know, the selfish gene is this idea that if we all just exploit each other, somehow that works out best for the community. What he has done is taken an abusive dynamic, an abusive exploitative dynamic, and then put it on a larger and cloaked it in the terms of biology of that's the way life is. And if you can get everybody to believe that, there's no reason to resist. I'm sort of jumping around here.
That's okay.
There's one more thing I want to say about this, which is that you know, so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And one of the things that means to me is recognizing that this way of life is not inevitable, that the atrocities are not inevitable, that that they are not natural. You know, I keep thinking about my sister who didn't know until she was in the eighth grade that not every father raped every daughter. And if you don't believe that there have ever been any alternatives, then there's absolutely no reason to resist. And so for whatever reason, you know, I got started on this path to resistance because somehow I understood that what was happening was not natural or inevitable. Those are a couple of the ways that my early background influenced my later work. I guess another thing is my father was pretty wealthy, and during my parents' divorce, he used the courts as another way to abuse the family. And so I learned early on to have a healthy distrust of the institutions of power. I mean, the judge was a tennis buddy of my father's, and so I learned early on that justice is not actually blind, or you know, justice is not actually weigh on the scales, or it can weigh, but cronyism and pre-existing predilections. That's another thing, is that the judge in the case when I was a young teen and an adolescent was a very strong men's rights advocate. And I learned that this whole notion of – I learned that justice is very politicized. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And so I learned those lessons really early on. And another thing that's very important to all this is that Judith Herman, who is a great, great writer and wrote the book Trauma and Recovery, she talks about how so often when people have gone through some sort of trauma or another, that it can have very harmful effects on the people, but somehow some people will take up what she and also Robert J. Lifton call a survivor mission, which is where you take the harm that was done to you and you attempt to bring this some understanding you may have gained from the trauma back and make that a gift to the larger community, which of course, if we want to go a different direction with that, is also Joseph Campbell's hero story. You know, he wrote Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is about how a lot of myths and a lot of fairy tales will have similar similar journeys in them. There are some commonalities among the journeys taken by the protagonists in myths or fairy tales. And quite often, what those are stories telling you how to live. And part of what happens in it is that the hero, and I'm sorry for the sexist language on that, the hero or heroine, we'll just change the sexist language, can go out and undergo some trials and tribulations, and then they inevitably end with they quite often end with the person then having gained some wisdom, gained some boons from the universe from these trials, and then bringing those back to make them a gift to their community. And that's, I think, in this culture that is based on trauma, I mean, that's one of the things that's part of my analysis, the larger analysis, is I think we have an entire culture that is not just individuals, but entire culture that's suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that in that we need, many of us who have been traumatized need to take on these survivor missions to try to turn this a different direction. And one more thing I want to say about this, and then I'll stop, is that I think so often of something a friend of mine says, John Osborne, he's a great environmental activist, he's also a doctor, and he continually says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And I think that that's one of the things that those of us who have been through these crucibles of abuse can attempt to do. Well, I guess I do have one more thing, sorry. one of the things that those of us who've been through these crucibles can do is bring back these understandings to the larger community. And what I mean by this is that when I think about what is different about my analysis than many other people's analysis, one of the things I bring to public discourse, which I did not see very much among environmentalists earlier, is the understanding that the dominant culture's behavior is not rational or reasonable. There are underlying destructive urges that are in this culture that, you know, when I was a kid, I was asking, you know, why is my father doing this? His behavior doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense to, you can make it make sense for a father to rape a daughter. You can make it make sense for them to beat the crap out of somebody, but it really does not make sense in terms of relationships. And so I brought that understanding that our, you know, my father would beat someone sometimes because the dishes weren't cleaned well enough. And I understood even as a kid that he was not actually beating someone because of the dishes. That's not it. There's an underlying problem within him that would cause him to do that or would lead him to do that. And then I bring that analysis to the larger scale, that it's not simply that this culture is destroyed the passenger pigeons because they were cheap meat for Boston. It's not just that. It's also that there is this underlying destructive urge that is central to patriarchy. One more thing, which is another thing that happened when I was a kid that was very important to all my understanding, was that when I was 7, I believe, there was a subdivision went in next door to where I lived. And prior to that, there were all these meadows with grasshoppers, prairie dogs, cottonwood trees. The subdivision went in. And I recognized, even as a little kid, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And I would not have used that language in second grade. The language I would have used in second grade is that if you keep expanding, eventually there'll be no more place to expand. And if you keep expanding, every time you expand, you're taking someone else's home. And I recognized that in second grade, which once again points out to me the fundamental non-rationality of the culture, because we have an entire economics that is based on infinite growth, and you can't have, and once again, in second grade I understood that that was nonsense. So those are a couple of the different strains that go through the work.
Well, those are huge, and thank you for sharing all of that. And it kind of leads into my next question, which is, you live in Crescent City, California, which is probably as far north in California as one can go. And Crescent City is also the home of Pelican Bay State Prison, which I understand houses some of the most violent offenders on Earth.
No, that would be the White House and Congress.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I stand corrected. I don't know if you're still teaching creative writing there, but you did at one time. And as I think about the incredibly important work you've done there, I'm noticing the irony of your violent background juxtaposed alongside teaching creative writing to these individuals. So tell us a bit about that irony, and also tell us about the impact of teaching these folks creative writing. What has that impact been on you?
Well, that's another really good question. And I think that the irony perhaps was not as great as it could have been, because I basically started it as a job. You know, as you know, as we're all aware, writing doesn't make a lot of money. And when I first moved to Crescent City, my writing career had not taken off at all. I had a couple books out, and Language was just coming out, but I wasn't making enough to survive. And so I took it as a job, and I loved it. And a couple things it taught me. One of them is that I was sort of this way anyway, but for me, when I went to teach there, the reform versus revolution dichotomy completely fell apart, because I recognized every time I was walking in there that I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And at the same time, a lot of my students were saying that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes together. Mm-hmm. So my lack of belief in the reform versus revolution dichotomy has caused me a lot of flack from people who don't think I'm pure enough. But, you know, honestly, when it comes to environmental stuff, or when it comes to anything, I'm very much a pragmatist. And I'm very much, you know, I don't actually care whether the prairie dogs survive because somebody uses laws to protect them, or whether the prairie dogs survive because somebody goes in and smashes the traps that are being used to kill them, or whether somebody goes in and, or whether there's a financial collapse that causes a mall not to be built. You know, it's the same with stopping violence against women. It's like, I don't care whether, you know, if somebody is an abuser who is, you know, sexually abusing their wife and family, or beating the crap out of the family, you know, I don't really care whether she's able to, you know, run away with the children, or whether she can just get a divorce, or whether he dies in a car wreck. You know, it's like, what's important to me is stopping the harm. Mm-hmm. And that was brought into really stark relief when I was teaching. And once again, I was fully aware that it's a big racist gulag. Another thing it did, honestly, is it demystified any romantic notions I would have of lawbreakers. That, you know, there's this long history of somehow conflating lawbreaking with being revolutionary. But some of my students, you know, here's what it really did. Let's be honest. What it really did is it politicized for me. What it really did is it politicized me about the drug war, because a lot of my students were perfectly nice people who would be great neighbors as long as you kept them off drugs. But if they had access to heroin or meth, then I would not want them as neighbors, because they're going to steal everything you have. And
right.
It really let me know that and a lot of my students were very aware that they were in there to provide job security for, you know, those in the prison industrial complex or the drug war complex, which doesn't alter the fact that one of the things I'm trying to get at too is that it raises really important questions about what do you do with people who commit strongly antisocial acts. Because, like I said, a lot of my students, I had a friend years ago, We had a friend years ago who used to always say that what she thought that people ought to do, what the government ought to do for drug offenders, is sentence them to college. Because a lot of my students, one of my students said, you know, what he wanted to destroy, if he could break one thing in the media, it would be the notion of a drug dealer in Armani suits. Because as he said, I got three kids, I live in Oakland, and you try raising three kids on minimum wage. And so he said, dealing put food on the table. And there's all that truth. And then there are also some of the students I had there need to be removed from society. Some of them were very, very scary people. I was never scared because it's all a very secure situation. And they wouldn't have done anything to me, but some of them were... well, here's another thing I want to get to, is that honestly, in a lot of the cases of my students, the ones who should have been in prison were their parents.
Right.
Because they... See, it's really hard, because what do you do when someone is so damaged that they are going to spread this damage to other people, but at the same time hold the understanding that when they were... You know, some of my students were put out to prostitution at the age of 4, at the age of 5. Oh. They saw their father shoot their mother with a shotgun when they were 5 years old. How do you recover from that? And so, you know, I, on one hand, I understood that, yeah, some of these people are so damaged that somehow we need to be, the rest of society needs to be protected from them. Some of them, I had students who tortured random people. I had one student who tortured someone completely randomly, tortured them to death. And, you know, obviously other people need to be protected from that person. And then here's another thing that came in through all of this, is that when a joke that I told, or a couple of riddles I told for years that came from my teaching at the school, this is really teaching at the prison, this is really the bottom line of my understanding of teaching at the prison. Two riddles. First one is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. The other one is, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full PAN benefits.
Uh-huh.
And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal. And so, you know, I was just talking with my mom about this the other day, but I'm actually not opposed to the death penalty as such. But I think there are things that one can do that can cause one to lose one's right to live in society, or to simply live. But I do highly object to the racist and classist application of it. You know, after the Deepwater Horizon spill, I don't understand why Tony Hayward – well, I do understand why, but I think that it would have been absolutely appropriate to execute Tony Hayward for the murder of the individuals in the Gulf, and also the murder of the Gulf of Mexico. And so my – and also I have to tell you that my feelings on that were pretty influenced by my opinions of my students, honestly, because a lot of my students – I heard this many times. A lot of my students said that they don't agree – with prison abolitionists, because they said if you want to abolish all prisons within this current structure, you're going to have to kill a lot of people, because there are some people in prison who, even without the drug war, even without all that, who are, I mean, here's the deal, is Martha Stout has this great book called A Sociopath Next Door. And one of the things she talks about in that is that some small percentage, about 4% or less, of people are simply born sociopathological. This does not even include those who are made sociopaths by terrible, you know, by terrible abuse as children. So some people are just, and the question becomes, what do you do with those people? And some societies have ways to deal with them. Some can neutralize their sociopathology by having social rules that reinforce behavior that benefits society as a whole, and by disallowing behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. Other cultures, like ours, end up rewarding some classes of sociopaths. So capitalism rewards sociopathy. What is a corporation except the reification of a sociopathological impulse? And so I think, and one of the things that the prison does, for me at least, is open a door to looking at the very schizoid, and I'm not using that term psychologically, but I'm using it sort of etymologically, in terms of the root comes from schiz, means to split. And so I'm not actually talking about schizophrenics or anything. I'm talking about a very split way of looking at the world that this culture quite often has, where some sociopaths are greatly rewarded and are turned into quite powerful people, given great power, and people who take that same, who have those similar sociopathic impulses, if they manifest in a way that is not supported by the culture, they end up getting imprisoned. You know, I interviewed Luis Rodriguez years and years ago. He wrote Gang Days in L.A., La Vida Loca. And one of the things he said to me was that a lot of these gang kids are really just doing nothing but manifesting capitalism in their own communities. They are, but because they are not given the opportunities to do capitalism within accepted senses, they are doing capitalism, selling drugs, whatever else, and that's still just as much capitalism. But because it's not socially accepted, they don't actually get to reap the benefits of it, as in buying a house and sending your kids to college. Instead, they end up being sent to prison for doing the same sort of sociopathic capitalistic impulse. So there's a very once again, using this in terms of its, there's a very split response that happens a lot in this culture, and that's one of the things that prison pointed out to me. It's the same thing. We see the same thing about the environment. You know, we can love our little kitty and our little doggy, as you know, this culture is killing life on the planet, and we can love a little nature park as the oceans are being gutted. And so we see this very sort of escapist. We see the same thing on race relations, that we can get really, really upset when one individual, rightly upset, when one white individual shoots several black individuals, but then at the same time we follow R.D. Lang's three rules of not discussing the institutionalized how many African American people have died because of poverty in the last, you know, in the same amount of time. We saw the same thing, by the way, at with 9/11, that there was this, oh my gosh, there's this, so terrible that, you know, 3,000 people died. At the same time, there's 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. And so we have this very, we have huge blind spots. You know, if we go back to my childhood, and then we go back and then we talk about my time in prison, one of the things that's holding everything together in those, and that I hope is coming through a little bit in this conversation, is that we have cultural blinders, you know, like those blinders they put on horses so they can't see to the side.
Right.
We have the same thing here, that we can see things very clearly, some things very clearly, and at the same time, we put on blinders so that we ignore all the things around that, and there can be these tremendous, these terrible cataclysms going on to the side, but then we completely ignore those as we focus on, you know, the splinter on our own finger. Mixing metaphors there.
Yeah, I'd like to move away from talking about this culture. I don't know if that's actually possible, but I'd like to move to talking a little bit about indigenous people and indigenous wisdom. And I kind of have two questions in one. I recently watched you on a Link TV program in which you were the moderator for a panel of indigenous women. And I remember that you said that one of those women had influenced you more perhaps than anyone else. And so I wanted to know a little bit about her and her influence on you. And I also, you know, both of us, both you and I, in our work, we talk about the imperative that indigenous people have to recognize the extent which with which we've been colonized, and to uncolonize ourselves, which you mentioned before. And in fact, if we don't commit to uncolonizing ourselves, we're going to forever remain hypocritical and ineffective in any form of resistance with which we engage. So I'd like you to comment on the indigenous women and the influence of this woman in your life, and also the whole issue of uncolonizing ourselves.
Well, the woman you're talking about is Jeanette Armstrong. And
yeah, yeah.
She's one of the most influential people in my life, and she's just a profoundly wise person. And I want to say that in terms of, not in terms of making wisdom something that is unattainable, but she's just a good, solid person who has, I once asked her how long she had been doing the work she's doing, and she said, "Oh, I started before I was born," because her people knew that there was. I think this is pretty interesting. She's Okanagan Indian, and in her community, they knew that they wanted that some people. It ends up, well, we'll just skip that. We'll just go to some of the things she said that have been really great. One of the things she said that has always really influenced me is that she says, we in our community have just as many squabbles as anybody else does. But the big difference is I know that my great-grandchild might marry your great-grandchild. We're going to be living in place. And so we know that we need to get along. And so they have developed tools to get along. One of them that she said that they really want to propagate is called Enowkin, Enowkin. And what that word means is, I challenge you to give me your most opposite perspective to mine so I can increase my understanding. And it's a conflict resolution method among the Okanagan. And I she was comfortable saying it to me, and I'm comfortable saying it to you, because she said that they really want to propagate this. This is not some indigenous knowledge that is not available to white people. This is something they do want propagated. And she also said it's very important. I mean, so what they would do if there is a major conflict in the community, they would have trained facilitators who could then get people to be expressing these different opinions, and then have the members of their community come together in different groups to try to resolve how this will work for the community. And one of the things she said that's very important about applying this is that it's also really important to remember that you can't do the Enowkin process with someone who is trying to exploit you. And the reason this is really important is because we are, I think that the abusive dynamics of the family dynamics and the larger culture, one of the things that does is it trains us to be victims. It trains us to be dependent upon the system. It trains us to be to identify with the oppressors, to identify with the system. I mean, that's what I was saying earlier on, that even when they talk about human extinction, most people still won't question this culture. Most people are still completely identified with the culture. So when I say, I want to bring down civilization, people immediately say, oh, you want to kill all humans, because they're so clearly identified with the system, such that humanity itself, in their minds, equals the system. That's right. Terribly scary. This yeah. happens on smaller scales, too, that we can say, it's so bad that we invade everywhere. It's like, I'm sorry, you didn't invade anywhere. I didn't invade anywhere. We're identifying with the United States government. There's a joke, and this is true, that about a year ago, my mom said to me, oh, it's so terrible that we torture. And I said, Mom, you torture? That's terrible. I didn't know that. And it's like, the United States government tortures. And by the way, I'm 82 years old and I'm your mother. Don't do this to me. And the point is that because we are so identified with the system, and because we are addicted to being powerless in the face of this system, I always hesitate when I mention the Anoukan thing because I know in my own life, okay, I'm going to go a different direction for a second. In my own life, I've taken on a one strike, you're out policy for people who are abusive. And the reason I do that is not because I'm so strong and so smart, but the reason I do that is because it is so easy to me, easy for me that if somebody starts to abuse me, for me to – I can get really outraged in the moment, but give me 2 days and I'll have their behavior completely rationalized and I'll be taking their side. And so I need to not have that in my life. And my reason for bringing this up is that it's so easy to say – yes, we need to have an Anoukan process. We need to have this process whereby you say to me what you want, I say what I want. But that only works when we're not cheating. And you can't go to British Petroleum or ExxonMobil or Weyerhaeuser and undergo an Anoukan process when they're wanting to cut every last twig or to take every last drop of oil. So that was something else. I mean, not only did she introduce me to the Anoukan process, but she also helped me understand that it can only be used when everybody is sincere. That's one of the things. And she defined for me decolonization. That for me, I mean, for the way she described it to me is what I said earlier about it's recognizing that this is not the only way to be. It's recognizing, you know, where I live now, that the Talawa lived here for at least 12,500 years before the arrival of this culture. And they didn't destroy the place. So how did they live differently? It's not saying they were perfect. You know, just like the Okanagans weren't perfect. They still – people get mad at each other. People get upset. But they recognize that they're going to be living in place for a long time. It's like so many people have said, you know, Indians affect the land base too, which means it's okay for Boise Cascade to do whatever, you know, to deforest. But there's a huge difference, which is that if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years – your decision-making processes will be different. You won't pollute the river. So, you know, I'm known for being really biocentric, but the truth is that if you're looking at the long term, then anthropocentric is biocentric too, because in the long term, you don't destroy your land base.
Right.
And so that was another thing. And one more, let's do one more thing from her. Let's see. The biggest thing of all is she was the one who really taught me that she was the first indigenous person who said this to me, which is that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. And the dominant way of looking at the world is consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to perceiving the world as other beings with whom you should enter into relationship. And that's a profound, profound difference, because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And if you perceive the world as consisting of resources, you're going to exploit them. And if you perceive the world as consisting of other beings with whom you can enter into relationship, then that is what you will do. If that's what you're taught from childhood, that's what you'll do. And so that, for me, decolonizing, and I got this from Jeanette, and I can't say enough good things about Jeanette. If you can, interview her. You know, everybody should interview her.
I will. Yes.
If here's another thing that Jeanette said that was really great is she said, you know, I can talk to you, and if all you're going to do is be excited for a day, I don't really want to waste my time. But what I want to talk to is people that I can say something, and then they will actually change everything in their lives. They will actually take this knowledge. And she will be tireless in talking to people if they'll actually use the information. But she doesn't have a lot of patience for people who just get excited but then don't actually do anything with it. And I've increasingly, as I've gotten older, found myself the same way. It's like I don't want to waste time. The thing is, you never can really predict. You know, there are some people that you know, I have, you know, that may resist what I have to say. And then you come back a few years later and they're actually doing great work. Anyway, those are some of the quick Jeanette lessons.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more question, which I've can imagine will take us to the end of our show today. It's only half of what I wanted to ask you, so I hope that I can invite you back soon and we can do the other part of this interview. But I have to say that your latest book, Dreams, is my favorite of all of your books. And the reason I prefer it is that it steps beyond any of your other books, in my opinion, into the territory of mystery and the reality of something greater than the rational mind of the human ego. It resonates so much with my writing and the crux of my work, which is about the transformation of consciousness and the necessity of experiencing an emotional and spiritual rebirth at a time when humans are clearly killing the planet. And in Dreams, you take to task a couple of the famous atheists, one you've already mentioned, Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, who, while they're claiming to be thinking outside the box of industrial civilization, are firmly imprisoned in it. And I have so many corners on the pages in Dreams turned down that I can't even keep track of them anymore. But in terms of the scientific materialistic perspective, you write, this is on page 151, "The scientific, materialistic, instrumentalist, mechanistic, managerial perspective, the belief that the world consists of resources for humans to use and not of other beings with whom we can and should enter into relationships, and the consequent belief that humans can manage the planet without destroying those they're attempting to enslave/manage, is a cult as faith-based and as impervious to evidence as any other of the monotheistic cults. In this new monotheism, which is really just the same old monotheism, meet the new God, same as the old God, man has replaced God as the ultimate deity. God is dead, long live man. And because it is based on power, pure power, the power to control others with no checks on that power, it is by far the most dangerous cult of all." And then a few hundred pages later, you say, "This whole discussion of proof gets to the heart of the problem with science and this culture, which is the valuing of the abstract, which is not the same as the invisible, or those who are not perceptible on demand, over the real. It is the valuing of rules made by this culture of projection over physicality, proof over experience, the quantifiable over experience, the superficially predictable over the willful, superficial predictability over life." I'd like you to comment on all of this. It relates to what you wrote in the preface of the book regarding, as you say, the messages where writing comes from, where dreams come from, and many other impulses and ideas and beings come from. Comment.
Excuse me. There's a lot there. I'm thinking of a few things. One of them is that I was really influenced by David Ehrenfeld's book, The Arrogance of Humanism. And I read that probably 25 years ago. And one of the lines from there that I've always remembered is that just because we can perform minor miracles doesn't mean that we can perform major miracles, but there's this leap that we can. And I asked him what he meant by that, and he said, well, you know, just because, I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was basically just because we can make a bicycle or an automobile, we somehow jump with no evidence whatsoever to the notion that we can then manage entire natural communities. And, oh, by the way, I don't usually use, you didn't do this, don't worry, and I don't care if somebody does, but I don't usually use the word ecosystem anymore because it's machine language. Mm-hmm. The word I use instead is natural community. And I think that that's really important for the same reason that we talked about, a moment ago about how, if you perceive the world as consisting of resources, if you perceive the world as consisting of machine parts that can be taken apart and machines that can be taken apart and put back together, that's how you'll treat the world. And I think it's another thing that David Ehrenfeld said that was really important was that, and it's interesting, he's Jewish and he is faithful to that. He's not just culturally Jewish, he's that's his religion. And he actually believes in that distant sky god, which I don't, obviously. And he believes that one of the good things about the monotheistic religion is that there is still some power that is higher than man. And I think that that's one of the things that that the movement from monotheism to science has been really problematical. Like I said there about it simply replaced the old god with the new man. And prior to this, there was still someone above us. And I believe there is someone above us. It's just that someone is the entire world. And there's another thing that's really important, I think, is that in terms of destroying the world, monotheism did the heavy lifting of desacralizing the world, of making the world not sacred, by taking all of our beliefs in divinity and in the sacredness of all being and taking it away from the earth and putting it on a distant sky god. That was the really hard part, is to convince people that their experience of this beautiful, wonderful divinity all around them was not real, and that instead the divinity belonged way out there in the sky. Once you've done that, it's really easy to just turn out the light. And all of this is based on the notion that there is not divinity in whatever we mean by that, and mystery. And see, here's the thing, is one of the mistakes we make in this scientific mechanistic world or worldview is that just because we can explain how something works, that means we understand why, and it means that there's nothing beyond that explanation. So we know now that plants communicate with each other, that if a caterpillar is eating a leaf on this plant will tell other plants, you need to change the composition of your leaves to make them so they're not palatable, this caterpillar. They'll communicate that. So they figured out that this is through the release of various chemicals. And then somehow a lot of people then presume that just because they understand how that mechanistic process works, that there's no magic behind it, that there's no intelligence behind it. But I'm going to do the same thing. We know that my fingers, that anybody's fingers will move together, that when we move our muscles, it's because of various biophysical processes, such as neurons firing, such as chemicals being released, such as chemicals interacting in your muscles. We know all that, but does that mean that there was nothing special, no magic occurred in the creation of Hamlet? Simply because when Shakespeare moved his pen across the page, we can describe the means by which this was done? And it's the same on the larger scale. Just because we can figure out that there are certain chemicals in streams that the salmon can smell to come on home, does that mean there's no magic that takes place in this process? It's completely absurd. And it's also really, science is inherently reductive, and science can do, based on the scientific method, and I say this as a physicist, based on the scientific method, it can do no other than destroy communities when it's applied this way, because what you do to figure something out in science is you get rid of all the variables except one, and then you try to extrapolate from there and build back up from there. And it's a really powerful way to know things. But on the other hand, it's presuming that life is like a machine where I can pull out the gear on a bicycle and I can put in an identical gear and it will work perfectly the same. but that's presuming. Okay, here's the thing, is if I have a chair, I can deconstruct the chair. I can have it sit on my floor for 3 months, and then I can put the chair back together, and I still have a chair. But if I take you and I pull out your heart and your liver and your spleen and I put them all on the floor and I let them sit there for 6 months and then I put them back together, you're not going to, quote, function, end quote. You won't be the same. There is something else. There is this magic that occurs when you have living beings, whether these living beings are rivers, rocks, trees, prairie dogs. And there's the point I'm trying to get at is that the whole is much more than the sum of the parts, which is not true for a machine, and it's not true for a machine perspective. And if you believe that a forest, well, there's two problems with believing you can manage a forest, which one of them is this, the belief that you can remove parts and then put in new ones, or you can simply remove parts and it doesn't matter. The other is, I love this line by David Ehrenfeld, that nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we can think. So even if it were a machine, it would be a machine that would be so unimaginably complex that we could not understand it. But even that language is really dangerous, because that implies if we just had more powerful computers. But here's the thing. Is there any will in the universe? Is there any unpredictability anywhere in the universe? If there's any unpredictability anywhere, then if there's any free will anywhere, then ultimately things can't be managed. And here's the bottom line. I will challenge you, I will challenge all of your listeners to name one natural community / ecosystem that has been managed by the dominant culture that has not been radically harmed by that management. And the answer is you can't name a single one. And here's another thing that kills me about this whole scientific method thing. We think we're so smart, and we think, oh, we learn things by doing, making mistakes and then fixing them. Well, I'm sorry, how many natural communities do you have to destroy before you figure out that your management systems aren't working? It's completely nuts. You know, you'd think that we would have learned a long time ago. Here's another joke that I tell a lot, which is, I'm going to name a pattern, and they say that the ability to recognize patterns is one sign of intelligence. I'll lay out a pattern, let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is, when you think of Iraq as the first thing you think of, cedar forest so thick the sunlight never touches the ground. No, that's what it was. You know, the Near East was heavily forested, Greece was heavily forested, North Africa was heavily forested, and this culture has been destroying the planet for 6,000 years, and a lot of people still don't see the pattern. And so where does mystery fall into this? I think that we need to, you know, I think it's really important to recognize the divinity in everything around us, but there's a sense in which it doesn't matter whether, and this is only one sense, don't worry, whether it's a distant sky god or whether God is in everything or whether the mystery is in everything, all of them imply a certain humility and a certain idea that we don't necessarily know best. You know, basically this culture is based on Father knows best, and that's right. It. And that's one of the things that needs to be decolonized, is just the... And we need to recognize that at the same time that we can't control them, you need to know that if you cut the trees out of a forest, then you've harmed the forest. I don't understand why people don't see that. And it's the same with anything. So what I see us as right now, what I see environmentalists as right now in the world, is the image I see a lot is that basically we're all EMTs or doctors or nurses in the emergency room, and we're all desperately trying to put bandages onto this patient who is bleeding out from 100 stab wounds. But the problem is, as we're putting these bandages on, which I think is desperately important, the patient's still getting stabbed, you know, and the madman is still there stabbing away at the patient as we're wondering why it's bleeding out. And one of the things I think is really important is to recognize the madman who's standing right there, which we can call capitalism, civilization, we can call it whatever we want, patriarchy, and to stop that stabbing.
Derek, we're just about out of time, and I want to say that I have only gotten to about half of what I wanted to ask you, so I'm definitely going to be inviting you back in the near future to continue our conversation. I just thank you so much for being here. I thank you so much for your work in the world and what you're giving us. And I so appreciate you and your willingness to come on the Lifeboat Hour, and I wish you all good things. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your work, too.
Thanks, Derek. Thank you, everyone. Join us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour. Goodbye.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed.